mattered most for how countries did during the pandemic was the level of trust in government and trust in each other in society.
In this program, what it takes to be resilient.
Those were the things that had the largest statistical association with lower infection and better vaccine coverage. And so I would argue that countries with better social contracts were much better able to manage the pandemic.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Munish Shafiq. Kristalina, I'd like to bring you in here. You've spoken extensively about the scars of this pandemic, and there's a fear that the poor are only going to get poorer.
What we saw in the pandemic is indeed the big difference between the haves and the have-nots. In terms of fiscal support and overall policy support, in rich countries, it is 28% of GDP on average. In middle-income countries, 6% of GDP. In poor countries, around 2% of GDP. And their GDP, of course, is tiny in comparison.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. Today, we present excerpts from a conversation between the director of the London School of Economics, Munish Shafiq, and IMF Managing Director, Kristalina Georgieva. In her latest book, What We Owe Each Other, Shafiq looks at the growing disaffection among people around the world and argues the need for a new social contract. The discussion was moderated by CNN anchor and correspondent Eleni Jokos.
Well, let me first start by congratulating Munish for a great book, and we will talk about it. It is actually so much aligned with what I'm going to say about the outlook and the policies that are necessary. We start the year with good news and not so good news. The good news is that the recovery continues. We are projecting growth in 2022 at 4.4%. The not so good news, it has lost some momentum. We had to downgrade our projections by 0.5%. And the reasons for this downgrade are twofold. One, the slowdown in the recovery in the United States and China, the two big engines of economic growth. And two, Omicron that has induced, again, restrictions in economic activities. When we look forward in 2022, we recognize that it would be like navigating an obstacle course with three main obstacles on the way. First, COVID, still with us, third year of the pandemic. Second, inflation that has become a bigger economic and social concern in quite a number of countries. And three, the mountain of debt. So a very, very delicate balancing act between tackling inflation and protecting the recovery. And that is particularly important for countries that are with very limited fiscal space, primarily because of high levels of debt. Just one fact, in low-income countries, from 2015 to now, those in debt distress or close to it have doubled in percentage shares. They were 30% in 2015, still high, but not as high as it is now, 60% of low-income countries in debt distress. And we see some emerging market economies also facing more of that pressure to service debt with monetary policy conditions being less easy as we fight inflation. So to take this all together, what it means is that in 2022, each and every country will be faced with specific conditions. In other words, asymmetry in problems and ability to tackle these problems, again, bringing monetary policy and fiscal policy hand in hand. That differs from where we were in 2020, when we all faced the same problem. The economy in standstill and the same response. Monetary policy accommodation, fiscal support for households and businesses. And that for us at the IMF means that more than ever, we are concentrating on understanding specificities in countries and then coming up with the right policy response and then the right capacity development and, where it is necessary, financial support. So 2022 would be a year when we need to cooperate even more because we are in higher uncertainty and more complex environment.
Okay, cooperate, working together. I mean, that literally was what we had spoken about at the start of the pandemic. There would be some kind of cohesion globally. But then there was a huge divergence that happened specifically with vaccine rollouts. And you saw the wealthier countries kind of hoarding vaccines. It was really interesting to watch from South Africa, where I'm from, and seeing how African countries and low-income countries have really suffered. And Manish, it's such an honor to have you with us. And I really would like to echo Kriselina's sentiments. It's such a brilliant book. And it was a real page turner for me. You've woven your personal stories and experiences that led you to your journey today. You observed inequalities at a young age when you were growing up in Egypt. And then you had to confront your new realities as an immigrant in the US. And it resonates with so many people. How are we going to rework this social contract through the eyes of the pandemic and what we've learned?
Well, clearly, the pandemic revealed problems in our social contract even more extremely. And I think I wanted to start by echoing what Kristalina said about the need for international cooperation. This last crisis has not been a high point of global international cooperation. And I think for poor countries, there was a real sense that the rich don't care, given what's happened with vaccine distribution. And there was no coordinated financial response like we saw in 2008. And I really applaud the work that Kristalina and colleagues, all colleagues at the IMF, did to try and respond rapidly and put in place financial support programs in 88 countries to help them cope with the pandemic crisis. But I think if we step back and ask ourselves, what did the pandemic reveal for us? We saw inequality increased. Vulnerable groups suffered the most, economic damage and health risks. And I think there will be a political backlash from this situation. Now, some people blame capitalism. They say profit-seeking, competition, globalization, that's what's caused the inequality, the destruction of human dignity, and the destruction of the planet that we've seen. I don't think that's the right answer. I think the problem is that we've seen a collapse of trust in institutions, a rise of alienation, populism, fake news, conflict. And at the root of that is a broken social contract that is a necessary underpinning for a capitalist economy to work. And because the rules, the laws and norms that govern what we owe each other in a society have eroded, that's left people angry and distrustful because society's promises to them have gone unfulfilled.
It is the low-skilled, the young, the women that have been most severely impacted in terms of loss of opportunities. So when we look forward, what is the lesson from this pandemic? That as we move to live into a more shock-prone world, we have to concentrate on building resilience to these shocks. Resilient people that are educated, healthy, with good social protection. So in a moment of shock, they are not falling into destitution. Resilient economy, not just the banking sector, which was the objective to strengthen after the global financial crisis. And we did it successfully. We need to look at financial inclusion, access to economic opportunities. We need to look at the economy in a broader sense. How can it be more vibrant and more inclusive? And of course, a resilient planet. And that changing our mindset, recognizing that in this world of today and tomorrow, we need to not only build this resilience in a comprehensive manner, but also work together in our communities, work together in our countries, work together as a world.
Okay, so Munish, I want to bring you in here because this is such a fascinating topic to me. And since we're talking about, you know, a new social contract, do we need to have new social contracts in the way that we deal with low-income countries and the relationship between wealthier nations and poorer nations? How important do you think that's going to be as we head into this sort of new era of post-pandemic?
We are entering a tightening cycle, and tightening cycles mean that interest rates rise, and that is usually a tough environment for developing countries. It means that that has consequences for their debt servicing costs. It means that capital flows back to advanced economies. So I think it is a huge challenge for emerging markets and developing countries. And many of them are entering this tightening cycle with already pretty high levels of debt as a result of the pandemic. So I think we have to prepare for a bumpy ride on debt sustainability for countries. And I think the mechanisms that Kristalina was describing are exactly the sort of things we need to be putting in place so to smooth out that bumpy ride as advanced economies raise interest rates to higher levels.
Kristalina, social protection, labor markets, and gender, that's our next theme. And it was interesting to see the social safety nets that were offered in the US and in Europe. And again, I was watching on in awe from South Africa and seeing that, you know, there was barely a dent being made in many African countries when it came to protection. But there's something called the Great Resignation, and the IMF has written extensively on this. I want you to give me a sense of the she session. So in other words, women leaving the workforce and what that means for the labor force going forward, and the labor market hasn't really recovered.
We have done a really interesting work in that area indeed. Let me start with women. The labor market participation globally of women is 20% lower than this of men. So women are an untapped resource for the well-being of their families, their communities, their societies. And that is an objective to pursue more labor market participation of women. Comes the pandemic, instead of going up, it has gone down. Women are in contact-dependent sectors, so they lost their jobs massively. Women have to look after kids that don't go to school because of the pandemic, so they are those that are leaving their jobs in big numbers. And women are those that overall are paid lower in comparison to men. So even from a family strategy, it looks better to keep the man employed than the woman. That is so much of a problem today, and that we know how we can resolve it. So building that appetite for resolution is what Minushi's book is actually advocating for. First, we need childcare, especially preschool childcare. What our research shows is that women that left the labor force and are not returning are in highest numbers those that have children under the age of 5. So concentrate on affordable childcare, good for the kids, for their intellectual development, good for the moms, good for the economy. But we also found some interesting trends in this retreat from the labor market among elderly people, so those that have stepped out of the labor market, that are in my category of age, are less likely to return. In the United States, in the UK, the empirical evidence shows that to a certain degree, this is connected to the fact that housing prices have gone up and equities have gone up during the pandemic because of this massive support that was provided to the economy, but also because people are concerned about their health with the pandemic still around us. So the elderly population is less likely to come back to work. And then the third interesting factor is the mismatch between those who left jobs with the structural changes imposed by the pandemic and the jobs they can go to. So what shrunk? Services. and to a great degree of contact intensive jobs shrank. What has expanded are jobs in e-commerce, jobs that are more in the digital economy that boomed during the pandemic. But moving people from here to there requires thoughtful skill upgrades. And we are not yet seeing these programs picking up in countries where the mismatch is causing a withdrawal from the labor market. And we are in a situation today when unemployment is very low, jobs are abundant, but people have exited, women, elderly workers, and people in shrinking sectors, they're not coming back. As Minouche says in her book, this is not a problem of the individual alone. It is a problem of society. And it can be only solved with the right policies in place.
You know, Kristalina, simply put, the system works against women and mothers. And yes. Minouche, I was so grateful to read the first chapter. You know, you were talking about gender. You were talking about changing roles, you know, over the past few decades and how the social contract hasn't changed in tandem with the changing roles of women. And you mentioned, importantly, Minouche, the forgotten women in the villages. You talk about the unpaid labor. Then you talk about poor women in the cities with no support, to the educated and fully resourced women in cities. The system simply does not work for these women in terms of raising children and also being plugged in fully to the workforce right now. So tell me, in practical terms, what do we need?
Well, so you're quite right. If you think about the social contract that we all grew up with, it was premised on the idea that women would look after the young and the old for free. And in a world in which today, globally, more women go to university than men. So you have all these talented women with huge amounts of human capital and much to contribute to society. And yet we still expect them to look after the young and the old for free. So clearly we need a new model. And I think we have to think about care for the young and care for the old as part of our social infrastructure. Just like we have an educational system and a healthcare system, we need a care system. And that means much more investment in the early years, which Kristalina mentioned. We know the returns to investment in early years education are phenomenally high, and it is the best place to tackle social mobility. If you kids born into poor families, if the brain development in the first 1,000 days of their life isn't supported with mental stimulation and good nutrition, no matter how good a school you send them to afterwards, they'll never catch up. So early years education and high quality childcare, which is good for women, good for children, but also thinking about a much better care system for the elderly. And I think there it's a combination of things. First, we probably have to expect most old people to work longer, given the fact that life expectancy is going up. And we depend on a smaller proportion of young people to support those old people. And so in the book, I argue that we should link retirement ages to life expectancy mechanically. And so that as we live longer, we should expect to work longer. And then we need better minimum pensions for the elderly. And we have care systems for those elderly people. That will enable women to stay in the labor market and continue to be productive. And this isn't just about equity, which is, of course, important, but it's also about efficiency and all that talent that's potentially going to waste in our societies by not making it easy for these educated women to continue to contribute to society through their labor, through their incomes, through their taxes. And that clearly needs to be part of a better social contract. And I guess I should add a footnote about unpaid work at home. The fund has done some fantastic work on this and shows that globally, women do about 2 hours more unpaid work than men around the world. Mm-hmm. And so redefining our social contract isn't just a public policy challenge, but it's also a very personal challenge for thinking about how we divide labor in our own families.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Every single day, this is an argument that I personally have with my husband. So I'm sure a lot of other women can resonate with it. I don't know why. It's still like around and he's great, but I'm like, why am I still doing more? But Minouche, in your book that really struck me, because I come from a grandmother that was married at 16 with 8 kids, no schooling. My mother only went to school until primary. Here I am today working for CNN. And the generational growth has been absolutely enormous. But let me tell you, when you said that in Denmark, it takes two generations from bottom of the pyramid to middle income, in Britain and the US, it takes five. And then South Africa, where I actually grew up, it takes nine. I mean, that makes me lose absolute hope. Anoush, how do we change those? Is this policy? It really worries me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think if we all talked about our grandmothers, we'd have a similar story. My grandmother was one of 17 children, certainly didn't have a chance to go to university or finish school. But, you know, she had the capabilities of being a CEO or a prime minister and yet never had those opportunities. And, you know, I think for me, the key policies are around education and early years and creating equal opportunities in the labor market. I think that's where the social mobility progress can be made. And I think it is no accident that, you know, we've seen a stagnation of social mobility in many countries. South Africa is a good example. Much of Latin America is a good example of that. The United States is an example where social mobility has declined enormously. And it's no accident that politics in those countries has been damaged by that, because in every society, a principle underpinning the social contract is that if you work hard and you try, you should get a fair chance at a good life. Mm-hmm. And the social contract in many countries isn't delivering that.
Yep.
It's not always like that. Priscilina, jump in here. Give me a sense of what you think of these generation issues.
Now you got me going. Let me first say that the World Bank put a number of what the world loses by holding back its women. And the number is staggering. $172 trillion lifelong loss because we are not providing equal opportunities to women as we do for men. So what do we need and where it makes a difference in mobility? First, access to education on equal footing. Second, access to assets, ownership that allows you to have the economic strength. Third, access to finance. So you actually, as a woman, you can start a business. Very interesting fact I learned about Africa is that African women tend to be more successful as entrepreneurs. They're proven to serve their loans better, to have better results in their enterprises, but they have six times less access to finance than African men. So how is this good for the men of Africa? It is bad for everybody. We have seen over the last decades an erosion of what is called intergenerational mobility. The story that you started from, your parents were better off than your grandparents, you're better off than your parents. Unfortunately for your children, this is no more guaranteed. And when we unpack why is intergenerational mobility slowing down or disappearing altogether, it actually boils down to access to opportunities and it boils down to gender equality that is still missing. What we advocate at the fund, we make the economic case. Womenomics should be a term we all use. Unleash the potential of women, we are all better off. And when we started talking about how we can solve all these problems, the new social compact, well, get more women in position of authorities, good things will happen.
I want to get into climate change and responsibility for the next generation. And Priscilina, you had mentioned the intergenerational responsibilities. And the current system doesn't work in favor of the climate scenario. Anoush, you said that we have to start creating incentives to want to be cleaner and greener. We have to create carbon taxes. We have to incentivize companies because we know behavioral economics. If there's no money behind it, or at least you're not getting penalized, you ain't going to be changing the way that you act.
Well, I think we owe the next generation an environment at least as good as the one we inherited. We also owe them, you know, decent employment prospects and to give them an education so that they can expect to have improvements in their standard of living, just like we've had. On the environment, I mean, I think the first thing is the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. We spend $4 to $6 trillion in subsidies to energy, water, and forests that mean that the taxpayer actually subsidizes people to do environmental damage. And the IMF has been at the forefront of highlighting this issue and helping countries to remove these subsidies. So that's the first step. Second, we need to invest in conservation and new technologies that are greener. And there's a huge role for public investment in those areas. And then third, we need to price things properly. And carbon taxation it's not a panacea, but it is a necessary part of the solution. The beauty of carbon taxes is it gets into the nooks and crannies of the economy. You don't have to read the label to decide if you're being environmentally responsible. You don't have to have a complex regulatory mechanism. Carbon taxes automatically change the prices of everything in the economy, so you will automatically buy things that are better for the planet. And of course, we need better shadow pricing and to price things properly to take into account the environmental benefits of those things. One of my favorite examples is a piece of research that was actually done at the IMF on the environmental services provided by whales and elephants. So whales and elephants provide about $2 million worth of carbon capture. And we need to take that into account when we value them. I think the final point I'd say is that we're in a world in which we have about $100 trillion of investments in infrastructure that will be made in the next 20 years. And my colleague at the LSE, Nick Stern, always says, if we make those investments green ones, we can make huge progress on climate change. If we change the incentives for how those investments are made through taxation, through regulatory changes, and through international agreements that incentivize those changes, we have the means to create a world in which people will have much better environmental futures. And so there is an opportunity. And I think in particular, the World Bank has an opportunity to play in shaping those trillions of dollars in investments in infrastructure that will come in the coming decades, and to shape those investments in a way that take into account the global public goods they provide and how resources are allocated between countries so we maximize the global benefits to the planet of those investments.
You're so right. Yes, during the pandemic, we worried that we might step back from action on climate, but the exact opposite happened. People all over the world became more sober. This little virus reminded us how dependent we are on nature and how interdependent we are in what happens to us. But what we are missing still is that sense of urgency, what we do now. At the IMF, we have embraced three very significant changes in the way we work. One, we have this duty to take the pulse of every national economy every year or every second year. It is our so-called Article 4 consultations. So we made climate an integral part in looking at economic performance and policies that are necessary for sustainability of this performance, including addressing climate risks and capturing climate opportunities. Two, we are now integrating climate-related financial stability risks in our financial sector assessments. So make sure that financial institutions report on their exposure to carbon-intensive investments and their exposure to investments that may be subject to natural shocks, to risks coming from climate change. Three, we are integrating climate in our data. So when policymakers look at their economies, they would see the climate data right there with their traditional standard macroeconomic data. And four, we are a financial institution. So we are creating a new instrument to play a role in this massive structural transformation that has to happen in this decade, not in 2050, but now. We call it Resilience and Sustainability Trust. It is going to be funded by countries receiving SDRs. We had a, you know, historic $650 billion SDR allocation. Some countries got SDRs, but they don't really need it. They have sound reserves. They can only lend through us to countries that need financing for the green transition. And this resilience and sustainability trust, we intend to start with 30 billion, grow it to 50 billion, maybe higher, will be providing policy lending, support for mitigation policies, for adaptation policies, for transition policies, to help countries not only take this turn, but do it fairly. So those parts of the economy and those parts of the labor force that are negatively affected by this transition, they can get also support. So to sum it up, the IMF, we think of ourselves as a systemically significant institution in the transition to low carbon, climate resilient economy with everything we do. We brought it at the heart of IMF work.
Well, Kristalina, what a pleasure to have you on today and share your insights with us. And I have to say that you're making us think very deeply about the things that matter. And let me tell you, climate change is one thing that we cannot compromise on. It is absolutely vital for future generations. I thank you for the work that you've done, Kristalina. Manoush, thank you for writing such an incredible book. And I'm hoping policymakers around the world are going to think about what you've said and that we'll be able to implement some of these incredible ideas and insights through your hard work. Thank you once again to both of you for joining us.
That was Minoush Shafiq, Director of the London School of Economics, and IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva talking about building resilience and the need for a new social contract. The discussion was moderated by CNN anchor Eleni Jokos. You can find the webcast of the event at imf.org. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.